This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Change is afoot for the 700 block of Sansom Street in Philadelphia, better known as Jewelers Row. Big development is moving in. We'll get the latest from Inga Saffron, architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll also hear from the Mooner Museum's Robert Hicks about its new exhibit memorializing the deadly flu epidemic of 1918. At least 20,000 Philadelphians died. But to begin, we head to Atlantic City, New Jersey, where the mayor's office is no stranger to scandal and corruption. Four mayors have left in disgrace in recent decades. The most recent, Frank Gilliam, who's pleaded guilty to stealing tens of thousands of dollars from a youth basketball league. Marty Small, however, is hoping to transform the office's reputation as he tries to move Atlantic City forward. Small is the new mayor, chosen to fill out part of Gilliam's term. And the challenges he faces are daunting. The city remains under state control. Residents are grappling with a huge property tax hike, and over 40% of the population lives in poverty. As always, if you'd like to join the conversation, send along a comment or a question. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. David Danzis is a reporter for the Press of Atlantic City, and he has been following this story. Hello, David.
Hi. Good morning, Mary. How are you?
Great, thanks. So, 45-year-old Marty Small is the 41st mayor of Atlantic City. What do we know about him?
Well, Marty is he's a local guy. He grew up in Atlantic City. He graduated from Atlantic City High School. His wife is now currently the principal of Atlantic City High School. So this family has a lot of close ties to the community. Marty himself, looks at himself as a champion of the people and has always touts his close ties to the community. So this is a local guy, and there's a lot of people pulling for him to be successful here in Atlantic City.
Has the office of mayor been on his political radar?
Absolutely. Mayor Small has never made any bones about the fact that he was always gunning for this office. He chose to not run several years ago against Lorenzo Langford. He did challenge Frank Gilliam in the 2017 primary and ultimately lost, not at the ballot box, but actually once the final tallies were calculated through mail-in ballots and absentee ballots. So Mayor Small has always wanted this position, and now that he finally has it, I expect that that's a dream of his fulfilled, if you will.
Mm. Let's focus on Frank Gilliam for just a moment.
Sure.
Of course, he resigned recently after pleading guilty to defrauding a youth basketball league he co-founded. He took, I think it was around $87,000. But even before the guilty plea, Gilliam's was a tumultuous time in office. Tell us why, David.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a difficult almost 20 months for Frank Gilliam in office, even before he was sworn in January of 2018. One of his running mates on a 2017 ticket, at-large Councilman George Tibbett, who is now council vice president, accused Gilliam of stealing checks that were intended for the entire ticket. Later, it came out that Gilliam had deposited a $10,000 check that was intended for the city Democratic committee into his own account. They actually tried to sue him to get the money back. He eventually returned it and gave it to the county Democratic committee. But even before taking office, his tenure was clouded. And then, there was the infamous nightclub fight at the Golden Nugget Casino outside the Haven in November, where he was with at-large Councilman Jeffrey Fauntleroy. Several things sort of stemmed from that as well, and including the entertainment director at the nightclub there filing a civil suit against Frank Gilliam to recoup $5,000 that she claimed she had lent him and never been repaid. They ultimately settled before going to trial, so no one really knows what the outcome of that was. And then, obviously, in December, he had federal agents raid his house, which included both FBI and IRS criminal division agents, and we now know why.
In his short time as mayor, was there any progress made?
So it's hard to say definitively yes or no, partly because of something you mentioned in your opening, which is the fact that the city is still under state control. So a lot of the executive decisions that get made in Atlantic City are done either directly or in collaboration with the state overseers. I will say this, during Frank Gilliam's tenure, the city did introduce two budgets that were lower than the previous year. He did work with the state, including Lieutenant Governor Shiel Oliver and Governor Murphy's special counsel here in Atlantic City, Jim Johnson, to try to advance the initiatives of Governor Murphy's administration here in Atlantic City. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to actually say that Mayor Gilliam had any sort of definitive policy that impacted Atlantic City in a positive way.
So, David Danzis, what has been the reaction from Trenton to Gilliam's resignation and the choice of Marty Small as mayor?
So the state has held steadfast that, you know, whoever is in city leadership doesn't really interfere with their goals and their agenda here in Atlantic City. Like I mentioned, you know, they had a positive working relationship with Frank Gilliam. I think they intend to continue that with Mayor Small. You know, Gilliam and Small are two different people, so they bring two different things to the table. And in talking to Shiel Oliver last week, she seemed excited about the idea of working with Mayor Small and his enthusiasm for growing the city's ratable base by bringing in either private investment or larger development dollars. She seemed very excited about that possibility. So I think, you know, the state is going to give the message that nothing is going to change here in the city. But I think you're going to start to see them be a little more aggressive in trying to diversify the local economy down here so that it's not just casino gaming. And I think Marty Small is going to have a big part in that.
And there was no whiff of scandal following Small into the mayor's office.
Not necessarily. I mean, Marty is someone who comes with his own baggage. You know, he was twice indicted and acquitted for campaign violations. He's had a few other small run-ins, but, you know, he's never been charged with anything. He doesn't have an outstanding criminal record that we're aware of. And as of right now, you know, politically, there's nothing hanging over his head. So, you know, he's starting off on a fresh foot.
Okay, so to the work ahead, Atlantic City residents are being hit by a whopping property tax increase. I think, David Danzis, it's over $600 for a home assessed at $150,000.
Correct.
Yet poverty remains a huge issue in Atlantic City. And Mayor Small wasted no time in going before the Casino Reinvestment Development Authority to try to get some relief. First of all, tell us a little bit about this relationship between AC and the CRDA.
So the CRDA was set up shortly after casino gaming was legalized here in Atlantic City. And essentially its function was to redistribute the tax revenue that was generated from casino gaming and put it back into the community. So they were tasked with sort of being the middleman in charge of making sure that the dollars were doled out correctly. Over time, their mission has changed considerably to now they're more responsible for sort of promoting and marketing and making sure that Atlantic City is putting its best foot forward. And they still put money towards capital projects to that end, but nowhere near where they used to.
But the CRDA has been accused of land banking. And might this affect Mayor Small's efforts to get some property tax relief for Atlantic City's residents?
Absolutely. So the CRDA has over 300 properties listed that it owns, and it doesn't pay any taxes on those because it's a state entity. So Mayor Small is both trying to get the CRDA to either put some of those back on the tax roll or, you know, start paying a payment in lieu of taxes to subsidize the loss of revenue. At the same time, the city has almost 300 properties that are currently not on the tax rolls as well. So local government, state government are both aware of that, and they're doing what they can to sort of alleviate that problem because, as you mentioned, although a large portion of the city lives in poverty, there's only about 26% of property owners in Atlantic City who are non-casinos, so just residential and non-casino business owners who pay taxes in Atlantic City. So there's not a large ratable base here in Atlantic City to prop up these declining tax payments that came from the casino settlements a few years ago. And the city's been struggling ever since to try to find ways to recoup that revenue. And I think getting some of those CRDA lands back on the tax rolls and getting some of those city-owned properties back on the tax rolls is one of Mayor Small's primary objectives.
What are some of the other major challenges facing Mayor Small?
Well, we actually just had an article this Sunday sort of talking about the looming possibility for another tax increase here in Atlantic City. And it's really through no fault of city leadership. There's several factors working against them. One is a citywide property revaluation that's taking place right now. The conventional wisdom is always that, a third of property owners are going to see their taxes go up, a third go down, a third stay the same. That's unlikely to be the case here in Atlantic City simply because they're already over-evaluated, and people have been appealing their taxes for years and years and years. So the reality is that much more than 30% of the population is going to see their property taxes go up. But the casino pilot bill that was signed in 2017 is also at play here because the casinos are capped at how much they contribute in tax revenue. And it's tied directly to what they make in total gaming revenue. So as the casinos do better, they're actually going to be giving the city less money, in a sense.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. It's a very interesting sort of crediting mechanism that was built into the casino pilot law that was signed in 2017. So $3 billion is the next benchmark. So if annual gaming eclipses $3 billion this year, which it's on pace to do, the city's actually going to get less money to pay down its future debt. And that poses a big problem because even though the state has come in and sort of helped stabilize the city's finances, it's done so while also increasing the city's total debt. I mean, it's increased by over $130 million in the last 3 years. So those looming debt payments are coming, and the city is losing, doesn't have the same revenue to pay it down. So there's kind of this perfect storm happening here where people in Atlantic City are really going to be surprised as their property taxes go up unless city and state officials figure out a way to sort of stem this problem while it's in front of them and not while it's happening.
Is there any legislation afoot to help resolve this?
Not that we're aware of. There several local leaders are trying to get the pilot bill either eliminated completely or have some legislative action that tweaks it a little bit because, casino gaming is doing better here in Atlantic City. And I think part of the problem is nobody really foresaw that happening. So now that it is happening, people are kind of scrambling to react they're kind of caught off guard, to be honest with you, Mary.
Yeah. And Marty Small, of course, has his work cut out for him. So, David Danzis, as a political observer, where do you see Atlantic City in 5 years? Are any of these major issues, will they just remain in existence?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to keep an eye on is sort of what the state is going to do going forward, right? Because right now the legislation expires in 2021, so the state takeover goes until 2021. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anybody locally that thinks the state is going to leave in 2021. So the state's going to stay here. And it needs to have a plan to sort of address these things. And while Governor Murphy has done an admirable job in his administration in addressing sort of the quality of life issues here in Atlantic City, they haven't really done much to address the city's finances. And that's a problem that no one really seems to have a handle on at the moment. But you also have there's a couple other things that are happening in the city, and it's going to be interesting watching going forward.
We'll stay in touch. David Danzis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mary.
David is a reporter for the Press of Atlantic City. Up next, Inga Safran is the architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We're going to talk about the future of Jewelers Row in Philly. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Change is coming to Philadelphia's iconic Jewelers Row. The Philadelphia Inquirer's Inga Safran calls Jewelers Row the oldest and most intact jewelry district in the country, a haven for skilled artisans and a popular tourist destination. But the look and feel of the 700 block of Sansom Street will soon be altered permanently and in a huge way. Construction is set to begin on a 24-story mirrored glass Toll Brothers condo building after the five properties from 702 to 710 Sansom are razed. Is this a beginning of the end to a beloved and distinctive part of Philadelphia's story? Questions or comments are gladly welcome. You can send us an email to radiotimes at whyy.org or tweet us at whyy Radio Times. Inga Safran is here to talk about this transformation. Welcome back to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary.
So before we tackle the changes, what is the significance of Jewelers Row to Philadelphia?
I think it's a couple of things. It is, according to, all the books, the oldest surviving intact jewelry district. Every city the big cities had these kind of concentrations of diamond dealers. New York, obviously, on 47th Street. Boston had one, probably some other cities. But Philadelphia's jewelry district has really retained its character and survived longer. Boston's is now pretty much being taken over by high-rise residential. It's very close to the Boston Commons. New York's is also sort of hanging on. There are other changes besides new residential buildings coming. You know, retail is changing in a big way. But, you know, this street being – it's not just Sansom Street. There's also part of 8th Street and parts of 7th. But, you know, the fact that it's so compact and that the buildings are, you know, from the 19th century or earlier – you know, all that give it its distinctive character. A really, you know, this is a place you recognize immediately with the red pavers on Sansom Street. It is so Philadelphian.
Let's talk about the change then. Last year, the Inquirer quoted Philadelphia architect Cecil Baker as saying, for this project to work, it has to look like a jewel. It has to look like a contemporary jewel in the neighborhood that is in the business of selling jewels. And then, Inga, I've read that you've called the project coming in an architectural zombie. So you've got a little bit of a disconnect there.
Yeah, it's been really unfortunate because on top of everything else, I mean, if Toll Brothers is going to insert a very different kind of building into the street, it should be, you know, first rate. And there have been a series of designs because people have complained about how bad the design has been. And, you know, not only are they utterly lifeless, I don't even believe that the last rendering we saw was a real design.
What were we looking at?
It was just like a glass slab. It had some folds at the top at the crown and some small setbacks at the ground floor. But what made me very suspicious, I mean, there are two things that made me very suspicious about this rendering that we were presented. One, I mean, they picked this site because a tall building there will have fabulous views of Washington Square. So, and it's going to be very high-end condos. And people who can afford to buy those units probably would like to have balconies. There were no balconies on this building. So that made me suspicious. You know, is this real? And the firm that produced the rendering is not known as a design firm. It's more known as a production firm. They're architecture firms with different specialties. So I just had my doubts, but it went through the city's civic design review, which is a voluntary thing. That board can't reject it. So now and it is a by right project. So, you know, they're not obliged to show us the finished rendering. And, you know, the city doesn't even really know what is it going to look like.
So, you know, life is about change, obviously. So if change is going to come to that particular area, the Jewelers Row, now called Jewelers District.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
What might work in that space, in your opinion?
You mean if it wasn't a tall building?
If it weren't, you know, if they're taking, I think, five buildings down and putting in a condo complex, what would work better?
Well, I mean, if they are going to take the five buildings down, you know, a high-rise residential building isn't the worst thing. I mean, perhaps it could be an office building, but that would be a high rise. I don't think it really matters in that sense.
But not something that's completely glass or what would work in your vision?
Oh, you mean in a design? Well, I think what would be better than the slab would be something with more shape and less uniformly glassy. You know, I've complained about glass towers elsewhere in the city. And, you know, it has been a thing. If you go to the Schuylkill waterfront, you know, like we have our own little Shanghai Pudong there. And the developer of that project has actually moved away from all glass buildings because it's become a cliche. There are bird issues.
Yeah.
They're not very interesting. Architects always tell you that they disappear into the sky. That's never true. So I think something with more shape, a little more sculptural, a little more interesting materials, something that did a better job of acknowledging the kind of brick and masonry buildings around it would be better.
This promises to be a challenging time, you know, for the merchants who are on the row. Construction can kill sales. Mm-hmm. How are jewelers preparing?
Well, I interviewed Rich Goldberg, who is head of the newly expanded Jewelers Row District. It used to just be a Jewelers Merchants Association. And so, you know, they've seen change coming for a long time. And so they've broadened their organization to include other kinds of retailers and merchants. There's a lot of restaurants now in that area. And they've adopted this sort of placemaking playbook where they're holding movie nights and, kind of little beer garden type things to get people to come to the street. They have an Instagram account. That's going to be hard to do while this huge fence is up. But, I mean, it is a good idea and it makes sense because apart from this tower, you know, jewelry business is changing and the neighborhood is changing. The whole east side of Broad Street, which was dead much longer than the west side, is now really booming, and we're seeing lots of new residential all around this area.
Back to Rich Goldberg. He supports this project?
He does. Okay. A lot of merchants do.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, some with mixed feelings, but, they like seeing something new on the street. The ground floor of this Toll Brothers Tower has, you know, the merchants have been given the right of first refusal to take the space for jewelry shops so they could have nice new space. I think they see it as a shot in the arm, as a diversification. I mean, I think others fear that once you change the mix, you know, you put a really upscale apartment building, it can never be the same place. Because one of the things that made it what it was that it was a little rundown. And when it's a little rundown, the rents are cheap. And
there's a certain charm.
There's a certain charm. You know, once you go upscale, some little hole-in-the-wall jewelry shop that fixes your watch is going to have a hard time staying.
How has the online world affected the jewelers of Jewelers Row?
I hear conflicting things about that. I mean, some merchants tell me that they really can't compete with online, that you can certain kinds of things, maybe a certain brand of watch, let's say, you know, it's the same no matter where you buy it, and you're just shopping for price, and therefore you go online. But then others argue, and I think there's some truth to this, that there's a lot of custom work in jewelry. People like to make, nowadays especially, make their own engagement rings, their own wedding rings. They want to customize it.
And you can still do that at Jewelers Row.
One of the most amazing things about Jewelers Row, which I don't know if everyone realizes, is it's not just like a bunch of jewelry stores. Because on those upper floors are this incredible beehive of different craftspeople who make molds to pour the metal, the people who pour the metal, the etchers, the polishers. I went up there a few years ago. I just couldn't believe it. There are like dozens and dozens of these people practicing these like lost crafts of polishing and etching. And I met the last like hand etcher of gold and silver jewelry in the region. So it's incredible. And so that's why I always call it an ecosystem, because it's not just a bunch of stores. It's all interconnected. And the reason that they can offer these custom products is because of all these craftspeople upstairs doing all this work. And now with, you know, computers and 3D modeling, everything is so much more sophisticated than it was before.
This is getting off the path a little bit, but I'm wondering if there are apprentices in those upper floors who are learning the craft so this continues.
I don't know if there are apprentices in the traditional sense, but certainly, you know, people go to school for jewelry making, to art school. And I do know some younger jewelers who do have space there and are applying what they learned in various art schools to making jewelry. And their jewelry is much more modern than a lot of the traditional stuff we see in the stores.
We've got a question from Mike who asks, why is Jewelers Row not a candidate for facade preservation?
Well, it is a cannon dish.
Okay, tell us about that.
What do they say? Always a bridesmaid, never a bride. After Toll announced its plans to build this tower, somewhat belatedly, perhaps, the Preservation Alliance nominated the whole street as a historic district. That was in March 2017. So here we are in October 2019, and it's still like slowly, slowly making its way through the review process at the Historical Commission. The nomination keeps being put off. The merchants say, we need more time to review this. How is this going to affect us? I mean, without a doubt, a lot of merchants own their buildings. And if the jewelry business isn't so great, we know the real estate business is very good. And a lot of them are probably not crazy about having the kind of regulation and oversight that comes with having a historic district.
There's a vote in December before the Historical Commission. Yes. What are you expecting from that?
I'm expecting it to be postponed, unfortunately. And it may—it's not clear to me. It may have already been postponed.
Okay. There have been other historic rows in Philadelphia, Fabric Row, Antique Row. Are there and more? Let me just take a quick break here. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. So what is the future of rows in the city?
You know, it's been pretty painful to watch them disappear. We used to have Antiques Row on Pine Street. Fabric Row on 4th Street. There was a kitchen supply district in Old City. Market Street used to be full of clothing manufacturers that supplied the department stores that existed there. So, of course, the world has changed. Manufacturing supply networks are very, very different than they used to be. And we buy stuff from China and we ship it to stores. And so... And we buy online. And so all these rows are disappearing. There's hardly anything left of Antique Row and Fabric Row. I think that there are a few fabric stores, thank goodness. Mm-hmm. I think they're mostly owned by one family. In Old City, the kitchen suppliers are virtually gone. Everything, you know, is real estate. And things are developed as residential, which isn't terrible. You know, it's good to have people living in these buildings, and we see new restaurants and other kinds of shops on these streets, so that's a really good thing. But the way retailing functions these days is different, and clustering isn't as significant as it once was.
As a matter of fact, that particular block, the block we're talking about in Sansom Street, that's undergone its own evolution since it was, in the early mid-19th century, since we first saw homes, buildings going up?
So this block of Sansom, the 700 block, was it was one of the first real estate developments in the city, and it was the original sort of row house row called Carstairs Row. And then, like a lot of residential streets in Center City, Chestnut Street, Walnut Street, they were built as, you know, grand houses, and then gradually the wealthy people moved elsewhere, and the ground floors of those houses were turned into shops, and they were modified, and that's what happened on Jewelers Row, because it didn't start out as a jewelry district. It evolved into one in the mid-19th century. It was the original home of the Philadelphia Tribune, Philadelphia's black newspaper. There were other newspapers located there. The Curtis Building was a publishing house. It was a publishing district for a while. So it's had many lives. I would never argue that it should forever remain a jewelry district, because I understand the world changes. But I think it's an evocative place just for the buildings that are there, which, after all, are only a block from Independence Hall.
So I guess the question is, as we move forward, how do we preserve what is the essence of Philly? And do you think that you know, people in city government really have a grasp of what that takes?
I think it's going to be hard because I think there's they privilege real estate development above all else. And they see that as essential to the city's financial well-being. And they don't understand these other things are important as well. I actually think there are quite a few jobs on this street beyond everything else because there are these artisans and it is cheap space for them. And I think that's worth protecting too. I think the only way the character of the street can be protected right now is through this historic district, mm-hmm. which may or may not pass. But there are clusters like this all throughout Center City of low-scale buildings. And one of the reasons that Jewelers Row got into this mess is because after the city adopted its new zoning code a few years ago, it upzoned.
What does that mean?
That means it made it possible to build bigger buildings throughout Center City. So Chestnut and Walnut got the same treatment. And so they, you know, people were very excited, and you know, because density is good for the city. And so they thought, oh, let's have more density in Center City. But nobody checked themselves to say, oh, wait a minute, if we tear down these entire blocks of distinctive low-rise buildings, we lose some of the essential character of Center City. And so it's a balance between those things.
The story continues. We'll keep an eye on it. Inga Saffron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mary.
Inga is architecture critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we'll be talking with Robert Hicks, director of the Mütter Museum, about their new exhibit regarding the influenza epidemic of 1918. Fascinating stuff. Stay with us. You are listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It is undoubtedly one of the bleakest times in Philadelphia's history. Just over 100 years ago, an influenza pandemic, the so-called Spanish flu, began wreaking havoc on humankind, killing millions across the globe. The U.S., of course, was not spared, and Philadelphia in particular was hit hard by a wave of deadly illness accelerated by 1918's Liberty Loan Parade. The parade was a World War I fundraising effort attended by tens of thousands of patriots who were unsuspecting of the deadly virus in their midst. Some physicians were aware, however, as was the city government, and the seldom-told story of what soon unfolded is illustrated in a new exhibit at Philadelphia's Mütter Museum called Spit Spreads Death. It is a fascinating and sobering narrative, and joining us now to tell us more is the Mütter Museum's director, Robert Hicks. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
So, why did the museum decide to tackle this particular story?
The simple answer is nobody else is doing it. Philadelphia has no monument to the people who died of the flu, to any of the heroic efforts of citizens to do something about it. We've got monuments to Civil War soldiers. We've got battlefields not too far from here, but not a single monument to the flu. Possibly one reason it's not in everyone's consciousness is it was happening as World War I was in progress, and we had a few months to go before the armistice was reached, but American participation was escalating. We had 1.5 million soldiers in France. As far as government officials were concerned, the only thing to talk about publicly was the war, support the war, buy more bonds to support the war. During the whole epidemic, or I should say pandemic, because every place in the United States was afflicted by this, the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, never made a single public utterance about it.
Extraordinary. And yet in Philadelphia alone, at least 20,000 people died. Tell us about, well, take us back to Philadelphia of the early 20th century, how people lived, what hygiene was like.
Philadelphia had, for lack of a better word, ghettos. We had a very large immigrant community, the South Kensington area, Port Richmond area, the area around the Navy Yard, particularly heavily inhabited by immigrant people. And this was an era of machine Tammany Hall politics. And if you knew the right people and had the right influence, you got city services, which means immigrant communities, these working communities, did not. No schools, no hospitals, no resources to speak of. So Poor people living in poor conditions is always a recipe for some disease outbreak. And when the flu came to town, it was no wonder who got hit first.
And then there was the parade in which thousands, you know, came out and they jammed Philadelphia streets for the Liberty Loan Parade. That's what it was called. And Robert, you say that some doctors knew that the virus was present in the city and the scene was set for a disaster.
Yes, there were physicians paying attention to the news. There had been flu cases in Philadelphia towards the end of summer from passengers on a British merchant ship, and they were quarantined and treated. There were a few deaths. But the news was reporting this thing called the Spanish flu, which was the flu, plus the U.S. Army training camps were also experiencing it. And some of these doctors went to the press and said, look, we know this big fundraising parade is going to take place. Maybe it's not a good idea for people to congregate. Would you be willing to post public service ads? And the newspapers would not run them.
Really? That's extraordinary.
You have to remember that this was a time of hypercharged patriotism. There were even two federal laws passed that severely restricted free speech. Any public criticism of a government program could be construed as a crime. So the newspaper editors were on the side of the juggernaut of patriotism. And if Philadelphia decided to back down from a parade, it would look pretty silly when the day before our parade, Chicago had a huge one. Other major cities are doing it. Even the President of the United States walked in the Chicago parade. This was something you simply couldn't back out of.
And the decision was disastrous.
The decision was not good. There were a lot of people watching this parade, which was the largest in Philadelphia up to that time. And the parade itself was miles long. But many people had the flu and didn't know it yet. And 3 days after that parade, every hospital bed in the city was filled. 2 days after the parade, the sickness was pervasive enough that the public health director, one Dr. Cruzan, finally, after great reluctance, declared an epidemic in Philadelphia. And into the first week of October, the mortality began to spike, and things really got out of control.
Describe, you said local hospitals, the beds were filled, the morgues, the cemeteries or coffins could not be built fast enough. Tell us more about that.
There was only one city morgue, and it only had a capacity for just under 40 bodies. So people began, in that warmish weather, to bring bodies to the morgue. They were stacked inside and out, and the city very quickly had to find other places to develop morgues. But because all city services were paralyzed, there really was a blue flu. Policemen were getting sick. One out of every 3 to 4 Philadelphians came down with a flu. And in a 6-week period, 12,000 people died, one every 5 minutes. So city services were almost non-existent. Remember, telephones had to go through switchboards. Switchboards had operators. Operators now sick. Taxis are not running because operators are sick. The city is really paralyzed. Even the mayor puts out an ad in the paper. Anybody who can lend a hand, show up and help run city government, which was eerily similar to what happened in 1793 with another Philadelphia epidemic, yellow fever. Mayor posted the same ad then. Anyone who was healthy and could show up and do something, show up. You'll be assigned a job. That's how Philadelphia is run. But the body count far exceeded the capacity of any funeral home to handle it. So people were reduced to burying their own dead, taking their own family members to cemeteries and leaving them there. Mass graves were dug by volunteers to deal with this now public health problem of dead bodies. And many, many people have family stories of the dead being left out in front yards for pickup. St. Joe's Seminary, they told the students, well, we're going to assign you a cart and a horse, and you're going to walk up and down the neighborhood streets and collect the dead.
Oh, goodness.
A scene out of medieval Europe. And this is 1918. Mm-hmm. This is airplanes, telephones, and mass warfare, modern era.
Let's talk about the research that you did to put this exhibit together. There were obviously thousands dead. The vast majority of them, really, quote, unquote, the unknowns. They were not, you know, necessarily famous people. But within the city, there's a treasure trove of archive. Tell us about that and what you were able to plumb to put this exhibit together.
Having no idea what was out there, we began to explore local archives and found a pretty rich treasure trove that had not really been used. For example, the Catholic Archdiocese for Philadelphia has an immense amount of correspondence and even photographs. Since, again, those seminarians burying the dead and taking the dead out of homes, their photographs, coffins stacked up, bodies stacked up, mass graves being done by seminary students. So they have photographs. I think the most poignant thing we ran into was, of all places, Drexel University has a costume collection. There was a woman named Naomi Ford, a very young mother in 1918, and she decided to get a jump on the Christmas holidays and buy Christmas presents for her female friends. So she bought a number of high fashion items, hand-wrote the labels, wrote little poems on some of them, and stashed them away for Christmas. And she died of the flu. Her family took her belongings, her clothes, and all these undelivered presents and stuck them up in the attic where they were for decades.
Decades.
So these presents, which all represent very high fashion things for women from 1918, are now in a costume collection, gift tags attached, gift boxes there, and they were never delivered. So we have on exhibit a purse that she purchased for a friend with her hand, with her tag, along with its gift box on display. To see undelivered Christmas presents owing to flu death of the Christmas gift giver is a pretty poignant thing. So we have that in the exhibit.
One of the extraordinary pieces to this story is that, you know, a century later, families haven't forgotten.
No. In fact, this has become the most unexpected part of this whole exercise on our part. We have an exhibition. We did a parade in commemoration of flu victims, and a film of that is now in the museum display. But people were spontaneously coming forth with amazing stories. And what is very, very striking about these stories, people were recounting tales told by grandparents. These grandparents were then children in 1918, and they're talking about their own families at the time. And what these stories have in common is there has been no diminution of pain and trauma over the years. In the century, these families still have these memories intact. They are very conscious of the loved ones that disappeared during the epidemic. One we received recently was from a woman who's descended from German immigrants, and this woman recalled her grandmother telling a tale of great loss of her mother, her grandmother, and her aunt all at the same time for the flu. So three intimate family deaths at the same time, and the grandmother carried this through to the present day. Now, she became the grandmother, in telling this to her daughter, said it was common in those days when you had parents die, or some of the parents die, to be farmed out maybe to other relatives and live with them. And so the grandmother, who lived to be in her 90s, said it was always a problem growing up because those of us who were shuffled off to other families grew up with very distant relationships to their family, and it was always a lifetime of pain. We get stories like this every day now. And some of these we've incorporated in our exhibition, but we're still inviting stories because we think we'll continue to accumulate them and maybe create an online digital scrapbook as they accumulate. And many of these stories have not been told out of the families before now.
This exhibit explores how Philly's various neighborhoods were impacted and how modern-day Philadelphians can learn about what happened in their own backyard. Robert, how does that work?
We mined an extensive amount of data from city archives. They have digitized all the death certificates of people who died during those months. Well, we recreated a database with material from them, and they're like mini biographies. They give the name of the person, where they're from, what they did for a living, how old they were, where they died, where their parents are. So we have created an interactive that allows people to look at their own neighborhoods, look at their own homes. Did somebody die in your house during the flu? This is one way to find out. Or perhaps you're a school teacher visiting this exhibition and you're overwhelmed by what you see. Maybe you want to step up to the interactive and see, did other school teachers die during this time? Or maybe you have Italian immigrant families behind you. You want to see, did other Italian immigrants die? You can do that. The devices we've set up allow people to make those kinds of searches. So you can explore your neighborhood. You can look at death certificates and even do some preliminary analysis yourself to see what you can make of all this death data.
And if I'm correct, one of the angles the exhibit explores is how future pandemics might affect Philadelphia's neighborhoods. Am I right about that?
We have a little bit in there. This is mostly about the social and cultural story of 1918. We don't delve heavily into the science behind this, but we have a bit. We do point out that the big killer in 1918 was the strain of the flu called H1N1. If you get a flu shot today, it's against H1N1.
Wasn't that the swine flu?
I think the swine flu, the last
I'm
pandemic
not 100%
was 2009,
sure.
Swine flu,
yeah.
Yes. And so we have Just lost my train of thought there.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. The flu will do that to you.
We're talking about the future.
Oh, the forward looking.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, we do talk about how closely disease outbreaks are monitored today. And of course, we know a lot more about the flu. In 1918, there was no vaccine, and they didn't know precisely what the flu was. But the research began in earnest because of the 1918 pandemic. And it wasn't until the 1930s they finally found the flu virus. The end of World War II finally found a vaccine that worked. So there's close monitoring that there was not in 1918, and we have scientific tools that we did not have then. We have a genetic understanding of the virus, and the flu is highly adaptable, and there are a lot of variants to it. So we tell people.
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY. So it's your belief that the official death count of 20,000 over 6 months might be low. Why is that, Robert Hicks?
Even as we looked into archives and gathered information and looked at what official reports were made from Philadelphia and from the region, we began to get a sense that there's an undercount. The precise count of who died of the flu or flu-related illnesses like pneumonia, bronchial pneumonia, may never be known precisely. Even for the world count, it could be as high as 100 million, could be as low as 50 million, could be maybe a little bit lower than that. Nobody knows for sure. Philadelphia is a good example. There was a public health director. He was aware of the flu. He technically had the ability to keep a parade from happening, but the political forces would have absolutely overwhelmed him. He would not have been able to stop that. But he was reluctant to believe that flu cases were happening, and he was not willing to declare an epidemic until there was clearly mass illness. What that meant for statistics is that the flu did not become a reportable disease until after this thing had really kicked off, meaning doctors who see the cases must report this. There'd be a common reporting mechanism and somebody keeping the data. That happened that way in other communities, too, that were slow to respond, or maybe the statistics are never very precise. So there wasn't any overseer of statistics in the United States the way we do have with public health programs today. So one locality may have done a better count than another locality, but even in a city like Philadelphia, we just can't be absolutely sure.
You mentioned earlier, Robert, that you hear a lot of stories, a lot of personal stories from people whose ancestors were affected by this. Do you take any of this home with you?
Oh, sure. I certainly take it home with me. And I think the thing that bothers me, and I suppose will bother people seeing our exhibit, people wander through this. They're going to ask the question of themselves, could this happen again? And if it happened, what do we do? And maybe I should go out and get a flu shot.
You offered flu shots, I think. Was it last week?
We have, yes.
At the Mutter Museum.
We've done periodic free flu shots, and we'll undoubtedly continue to do that over the next few years while this exhibit is up. But the...
So we were talking about, you know, what might happen if this, this were to happen again.
Well, there was a World Congress of Epidemiologists in 2016 to prognosticate what's likely to happen in the world. And they thought over the next century, we're likely to have four pandemics, one of which is probably going to be the flu. Because the flu is so adaptable and so variable, epidemiologists are keeping an eye on places like China at the moment, where there's an H5N9 strain that kills about one out of every two people who get it, but it hasn't made a major crossover yet from animals to people. But if it does, it travels the world in hours.
Story remains to be, it's ongoing, so we'll obviously keep an eye on it. Robert Hicks, so great to have you with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Robert Hicks is director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. The exhibit is called Spit Spreads Death, and as always, we invite our listeners to join us on social media. Just head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.